When you're in the infinite inning, you're surrounded by a combination of dark matter and blame. These are the secret forces that bind the universe together. The problem is that blame is not so easy to assign. Every phenomena that we experience undoubtedly has a cause. That's just the way things work, but not one we can always see. The butterfly effect is a very old idea that explains some of this, that you budge some small molecular-sized grain and the whole of history changes. A butterfly sitting on a leaf in, Milwaukee flaps its wings, stirring the breeze just that much. And if you want things in baseball terms, that butterfly flapping its wings, that gives a Christian Yelich fly ball just that minuscule amount of added impetus from the breeze to clear the wall for a home run. And if you were rooting against the Brewers that day, your day has now gone from good to bad, all because a butterfly did what butterflies do. I would like to point out two flaws in the butterfly effect idea. First was one that the people who formulated this concept, and it goes back a long way, could not have anticipated. Masses of butterflies are now going extinct due to habitat loss and pesticides, so we're going to get to find out what happens to causality during a massive ecosystem breakdown. Maybe it just stops. Alternatively, it might become a lot less subtle. 10 million butterflies don't flap their wings and everybody dies. The second flaw, I sometimes wonder about, is when causality is less subtle and mysterious, which is to say that a butterfly flapping its wings isn't responsible for your having a bad day. The flapping's just gravy. It's the smallest, most infinitesimal part of chance being arrayed against you, because all of chance is arrayed against you. The totality of everything is causing you to have a bad day. And if you can have days like that, then causes have to be next to impossible to discern which butterfly was the true assassin, especially if several of those butterflies flapping their wings caused other people to undertake actions which have influenced your actions, which ruined your day or your life, or ultimately deflected you quite innocently onto a path in which you concluded the day's events by plunging down an open manhole. Your boss was having a bad day, not you, because he, not you, has a gambling addiction and bet that the Dodgers would beat the Brewers, and Yelich's home run, which was caused by the butterfly, caused him to drop a grand he couldn't afford to lose. So when you were 5 minutes late because the barista at Starbucks screwed up your burnt coffee order, which you were only picking up to be nice to him anyway, caused you to be 5 minutes late to work, and then he chewed you out, which meant that you spent the day stewing and feeling insecure about your job and therefore nervous about money matters. And your wife or girlfriend, not knowing this, when you walk into the home at 5 or 6 o'clock that evening, suggests that she doesn't feel like eating in tonight. Let's go out. Let's have something fancy. You can't quite bring yourself to say, "No, Harriet, tonight's not the night for us to spend $100 on dinner. I just don't feel comfortable doing that," because you haven't processed everything that you've gone through yet. And so instead, you say something snide about how eating out is a bad idea when Harriet's gained so much weight lately. And Harriet, whose own butterflies have been flapping all day, prodding at her insecurities that were instigated years ago by her mother fat-shaming her as a child to the point of near nervous breakdown and definitely borderline anorexia, none of which you know about, throws a tea kettle at you, which you duck, and it impacts with the glass frame covering your signed Alan Trammell rookie card, which Harriet then steps on as she's grabbing the cat, and this will only strike you later, snags her already packed suitcase. Why was it already packed? To leave you forever. So does that run of bad luck start with the butterfly, Christian Yelich, your boss, or you? Or maybe it's not bad luck. Maybe it's just Christian Yelich can really freaking hit. So we know there are reasons for things. You can't always trace them, can't always find the exact fault in the system. Injuries are like that. Joel Sherman, writing in the New York Fox News Post last week, after Yankees first baseman Greg Bird was placed on the injured list with a torn left plantar fascia, composed this lead. Greg Bird became the 13th player the Yankees have sent to the injured list, the 12th currently on it, yet Brian Cashman continues to defend the team's medical and training staff. Now, some of Sherman's passive aggressiveness there relates to the sheer number of injuries the Yankees have had in the early going, with Aaron Judge having been placed on the injured list subsequent to that article being written, some of it because ace pitcher Luis Severino mysteriously developed a lat strain while on the injured list recovering from right rotator cuff inflammation. I guess the inference to make there is that when baseball changed from disabled list to injured list, it also means that instead of just getting medical treatment for a present injury, you're placed in a protective cocoon, which renders you invulnerable to further insult while you're healing from the original injury, because no one has ever been hurt while already hurt in the history of the world. Therefore, the only logical inference to draw is that Luis Severino did not just develop a lat injury, but that while he was repairing his right rotator cuff, someone took a tire iron to the rest of his body with the intention of inflicting harm. Which, of course, is ridiculous. It's pandering to the kind of audience who would read the New York Fox News Post in the first place. I'm not sure why Severino's injury is supposed to imply that the training staff was negligent with him. It seems like a communications issue. Severino has said that the lat problem was there all along with his rotator cuff problem, but maybe he told the team, maybe he didn't. The training staff seems not to have seen it until a subsequent MRI. Brendan Cuddy of NewJersey.com quoted Cashman as saying the team hadn't treated Severino as if he had that strain because his scans hadn't shown that there was one. Part of treatment protocol is to treat the patient and treat the MRI, and sometimes they don't match up. We're trying to piece it all together. He also said that Severino had been going through his rehab, quote, without complaint, which again suggests a communications issue. Doctors aren't clairvoyant. You've all had the experience where you say to somebody, you know, I feel like I might have a bit of a fever. My throat's a little scratchy. And they say, maybe you ought to go see the doctor. And you say, nah, or I'll give it a couple of days and see what happens, and if it gets worse, I'll go. Well, if you make that decision, your doctor's not clairvoyant. He's in some office 15 miles or 30 miles away, and he's doing whatever he does, just like the old butterfly, and he's not sitting there thinking, I wonder if Ralph has got a scratchy throat today. No, he's busy removing somebody's pancreas or some such. And even if you do go and he orders tests for you, diagnostics are not so sophisticated in this era that they are perfect, that they always get the diagnosis correct, which is to say that if you tell the doctor, my throat is sore, and the doctor looks down your throat with his little flashlight and says, well, I don't see any infection in there, therefore, your throat is not sore. That is not accurate. Damn it, your throat is sore. He cannot deny you your experience. He can only tell you what is not causing it, not that it doesn't exist. Therefore, if Luis Severino did not go to the trainers, point to his lat, and say, I feel ow, or if they sent him for an MRI, it came back clean, and he didn't insist, I feel ow anyway, regardless of what the damn MRI said, then it's hard to find fault with the doctors or the trainers. And that's a point that I would like to make generally as kind of a public service announcement for all of you. Anyone who has ever been to a doctor, I mean for anything, knows that communication is key, especially at a time when your physician most likely spends more time looking at his computer or his tablet than he does examining you. You really have to force them to listen and pay attention. They are overbooked, they are distracted, and maybe they're reading your test results, your specific test results, which is about working on you, but that doesn't mean they're listening. So at the moment that they may be looking at your cholesterol numbers and thinking, okay, well, Jim here is not in any danger from his cholesterol production, you may be trying to get across the idea that a lion has chewed off your arm and you are presently in danger of bleeding out. If you don't mind, I'll relate this to my own experience for a moment. Among my many medical issues is a small, benign adrenal tumor that causes hypertension. One of my doctors inferred that it existed from my blood chemistry, so he sent me for an MRI to confirm that it was there, and the MRI came back saying that I did not have one. So scratch that theory. The problem was that I did and do have one. The way the radiologist wrote the report, and I subsequently saw it, he wrote two pages, and I'm not hyperbolizing here, he spent the entirety of one page restating over and over again, it doesn't seem like Steve has one of those tumors. And then he went one line over onto the next page, And it said, then again, he probably does. And the doctor, reading the report, never scrolled down far enough to read the second page because he felt satisfied, having seen restated 17 times that the test was negative. He only saw the last line when I drew his attention to it, and that was 6 months later, so I didn't get treated for an extra half a year, and now my hypertension is gone. I'm great. I may yet be killed by the arm the lion chewed off, but that's another story and not this doctor's speciality. If I want to identify my causal butterflies in that instance, the 6 months of treatment I didn't get, then I'm not sure whether it's the radiologist who wrote badly or the doctor who read too quickly or, well, my fault for having the damn tumor in the first place. And for all I know, the only reason that the tumor established itself was because on the day that some cell division went badly, creating a malformation, I had a cold and therefore my immune system was a little distracted and failed to clean it up. Or maybe it's my father's fault because he's had them too, so it's all heredity. And that means it's not his fault, but some distant ancestor of ours. And really, the only thing you can do at that point is say, screw causality. Sometimes people just get sick or injured. And if you're a real jerk of a boss, then you can assign fault to some trainer who forgot to put a hot towel on a certain spot on a certain day. But really, that's ridiculous. And parenthetically, George Steinbrenner used to do that kind of thing all the time when his entire roster of 38-year-olds would become injured somewhere in the 1980s because they failed to anticipate, and therefore prevent, injuries to this cast of athletic senior citizens. That's not how medicine works, whether you're a trainer or a doctor. That's why, again, a lot of these matters of things not being diagnosed are about communications issues. If you're lucky enough to have access to regular health care, when you have a physical every 6 months or once a year, the doctor takes a very general look at your health. Is anything obvious broken? Is anything weird growing off of you? They don't automatically send you for a liver biopsy unless you complain about your liver or you're having nosebleeds and turning yellow. Even if you're really paranoid about your liver for some reason and say to the doctor, I am worried. Please send me for a liver biopsy. Your doctor is going to say, well, Chuckles, I would, but since you're asymptomatic, your insurance company isn't going to pay for it. You want to go out of pocket $10,000 on liver tests? And most of us, we can't afford to do that. And if we could, it would be a bad thing because all of medicine would break down due to a flood of healthy people forming lines to use the scanners such that the sick people got crowded out. But say we did. In fact, say, due to an exciting advance in cell phone apps or Star Trek tricorders or some such, we had real-time internal medical monitoring 24/7. You know what we would find? We would find that all of us are getting cancer every day, all the time, and our immune system clears it up. And we would find that everything that you do, whether throwing a 95-mile-per-hour fastball with great effort, to getting up off the couch to refill your Coke during a slow spot in tonight's Game of Thrones, puts one at risk for a hamstring tear or a rotator cuff injury. The only true preventative medicine is to get in a freezer, take a deep breath, and close the door, and that has consequences of its own. In 1983, the Yankees had a shortstop, Andre Robertson, who had a good enough glove that he might have been a 5-year starter for someone in spite of what was a very, very weak bat. But he was in a serious car accident that year. He was out driving with a friend, a female friend, at about 5:30 a.m. on the morning of August 18th. That was the day of the conclusion of the Pine Tar game, if you want to situate it historically. He was driving down the West Side Highway in Manhattan, and as young men often do, particularly at a time of day when there is no traffic whatsoever, he was speeding a little, not a lot. He reached, at 72nd Street, a poorly signed S-curve. There wasn't a lot of warning that it was coming up, and so, when he went into it, he lost control of the car, hit a wall, flipped it, and both he and the young woman were thrown out of the vehicle. In some senses, the crash was a miracle because neither was killed. However, the young woman was paralyzed for life, and Robertson suffered many injuries, the most serious of which, from a living point of view, was a broken neck. But from a baseball point of view, he severely dislocated his shoulder, his throwing shoulder. It was never the same. And since all he had to offer on a baseball diamond was defense, well, if you couldn't play shortstop anymore, he couldn't play. And my question is, why didn't the Yankees fire their medical staff for doing a poor job of teaching their young middle infielders traffic safety, or for that matter, the right acrobatic techniques and presence of mind such that if you are thrown from a moving vehicle, you roll lethally like a cat and land on your feet, suffering minimal harm? I should add, by the way, that this particular case is instructive for those of us who would be tempted to excoriate a team's training staff and blame it for injuries, because all we know is what the teams tell us, and that is not always accurate. In the case of Robertson's car accident, no one knew what had actually happened for a long time for two reasons. One, the Yankees lied. They initially told the press that Robertson had suffered a broken rib, a mildly separated shoulder, a moderate to severe neck sprain, and abrasions, lacerations, and contusions. I guess you could call a broken neck a sprain in the same way you could call having your head chopped off by a guillotine a headache. It's all how you look at it. But here's one thing that we can look at with a bit of familiarity. The other reason that no one knew what happened was that Steinbrenner's lawyer, Roy Cohn, intervened to prevent the police from interviewing Robertson. P.S. They then fined the bedridden Robertson $5,000 for being, as Casey Stengel once put it after Don Larson got into his own less damaging Twilight Hour car accident, either out too late or up too early. This past weekend, a very good story was posted on ESPN by Michelle Steele. It's about the White Sox reliever Danny Farquhar, who, you might recall, nearly died of a brain aneurysm during a game in which he was pitching last April 20th. The story is an oral history, so it's told through the words of its participants, including Farquhar, his wife, and White Sox trainer Herm Schneider. Farquhar doesn't remember much of what happened that day. I think the last thing he said he recalls is the national anthem. So it falls to Schneider to detail their interactions when the aneurysm broke. Schneider says that Farquhar came off the field complaining of a headache and that he, Schneider, offered him some Tylenol. It's not clear from the way things are worded if Schneider actually gave it to him, but regardless, a few minutes later, Farquhar said that the headache was worsening. These are Schneider's words. And I waited a few minutes, and he said, "Oh, geez, Herm, it's really getting worse. It's really kind of hurting." I said, "Do you think you can keep pitching?" Because he was going to go back out and pitch, and he said, "I don't think so. He's like pulling on his hair that his head is hurting that bad." I said, "Danny, you okay?" "My head is absolutely killing me. I'm having the worst headache I could have." Then all of a sudden, he starts to vomit. He starts to lean, to fall, because he's passed out. In my own head, I said, "Please, Danny, don't die on my watch here." Schneider spent 40 years with the White Sox and he retired after last season. I don't know if that's because after 40 years you've had enough and you'd rather go fishing than treat groin pulls, or he just said, "You know, when players start stroking out in the dugout or having brain bleeds that I've got to deal with, it's time to move on." But either way, he's gone. And I asked, does the fact that he failed to anticipate that a seemingly healthy 31-year-old male athlete's brain was bleeding invalidate those 4 decades of service? No. He's neither a neurologist nor is he clairvoyant. He did the best that he could under the circumstances. And if you had a neurologist in the dugout, I don't know that he would have jumped to that conclusion faster than Schneider did, if Schneider ever got there, because no one does. I guess the NFL has that now. But even had Farquhar been in the NFL, no one would have been putting him in the concussion tent for evaluation because he hadn't been hit by anything. They would have been slow to cotton to what was happening as well. And P.S., if you jump to a wrong conclusion trying to help a sick person and administer the wrong aid, you could do them more damage than that you're trying to prevent, and you'll be liable too. At the risk of injuring you by pounding this analogy too hard, a concluding thought: on May 9th, 1864, the Union General John Sedgwick was setting up his artillery during the Battle of Spotsylvania Courthouse. He was standing right out in the open, and a subordinate, let's call him the general's trainer, cautioned him that the rebels had snipers out there. In fact, there were bullets whizzing about at the time, so the general might have observed this fact for himself. "Get down," the general was told. they themselves had gotten down. The general scoffed. They couldn't hit an elephant at this distance. And just as he said that, a Confederate sharpshooter put a bullet right under his left eye, killing him, which in fact does not disprove his statement, given that he was not an elephant. An elephant would have been fine. And that's why the next day, the New York Post published an article questioning the Yankees elephant trainer. I'm Stephen Goldman, and this is The Infinite Inning. To the show, episode 101. I'm not going to count them off every time, but it feels good right now. Allow me to feel good for a moment. This week, my guest is Bill Baer of Hardball Talk. He was the founder of the influential Phillies blog, Crash Burn Alley, and then graduated to Craig Calcaterra's crew, where he contributes to the coverage with opinions and updates of his own. I've enjoyed his work and his perspective for a long time, and I thought it would be cool to talk to him. He's also the author, I should mention, of one of those Before You Die books, in his case applying to the Philadelphia Phillies. I have to tell you, I don't keep books like that in the house. I don't care how good they are. Some of them seem rather intriguing. 1001 Movies to See Before You Die, 1001 Places to Visit Before You Die. I mean, that wouldn't work for me anyway, because as you know, I'm kind of a homebody. And I'm just not climbing any cliffs at this stage of my life, I'm afraid. So if the most wonderful secret temple is on top of that cliff, I leave it to Indiana Jones to get there. I will cheer him from the sidelines and offer him a cup of water when he comes back down, or coffee, something harder even, but I'm not going myself. So all it's going to do is make me feel bad. But having those spines pointed out, I know this is strange, but you know I'm a bibliophile. I have stalagmites all over the place that I'm constantly tripping on and having to restack after I fall over them. And I really do think about the way a book's spine will look facing out on the shelf once I'm done with it. That's like my hunting trophy. I have bagged that book. And I just don't want the word die before you die facing out at me all the time. I got enough problems not thinking about that continually. I've been thinking about it continually since practically I was born. And so, you gotta watch this movie before you die. Well, is that Tuesday? When is that? I don't want to have to deal with that. So, I'm sure Bill's book is great, particularly if you do want to check off some kind of lengthy bucket list of Phillies-related activities. And look, I'm sympathetic to that. I'll go with you. Just don't tell me your purpose. If you want to call me up and say, Steve, we've got to go visit the burial place of Sherry McGee, the great Phillies outfielder of the 1910s. Steve, there's a spot in Philadelphia. It's currently a used car lot, but back in the day, this was a place that Grover Cleveland Alexander really went on one of his famous benders, and I feel like we should go this week because the book says you have to see it before you die. You can't go after you die. That is the wrong order of operations. I am going to wonder, what does Chet know about my health that I don't know? Or is it that he just looks at me and sees someone far more obese and decrepit than I do, and that my belief that I am not shuffling off this mortal coil within the next, well, few hours apparently, is just an act of denial? Well, in that case, I don't have time to go to Philadelphia anyway, Chester. Seriously, though, and if you don't mind this mild digression, you've heard me talk on this show about a very good friend of mine, one of my best friends, who was a high-ranking employee with the Yankees once upon a time and was treated in the most shabby way possible. This was part of me losing my own fandom. I saw him yesterday, and he said, I ran into this guy who was so big, I can't tell you how big, he was so obscenely large, it's hard to put into words. Well, He was bigger than you, is what I'm trying to say. And I actually stopped and asked, because when you've had this kind of closeness to a friend, someone who, I've never had a brother, I only have a younger sister, but I assume that were I to have a brother, we would be as close as brothers are, perhaps closer, judging by his own relationship with his brother, which is sometimes antagonistic, ditto my relationship with my sister. I knew I could ask for total honesty and we'd still be pals afterward, no matter what he said. I stopped and I said, honestly, what do you see when you look at me? Do I just look like Jabba the Hutt? What is it that you're trying to say to me about how I need to adjust my self-image? Because I know I'm too big, but I'm not that big, am I? You don't look at me and think flesh mountain, do you? And he said something equivocal about needing to lose a few pounds himself, and I just let it go at that because, you know what, there's no amount of shaming that is too intense for me right now, because as you know from my telling you about my recent adventures in angioplasty, me and CC Sabathia, we're balloon brothers now. I need to lose all the weight that I can, and so bring on the fat shaming. I'll put it to good use, motivating myself to stay away from that slice of pie. What a good looking slice of pie that is. Really though, that's not the main problem. The main problem is just convincing myself to get on the treadmill on a regular basis and stay on it for, 20 consecutive hours or so. Before I roll Bill in here, I have one more discussion I'd like to have with you, and also a programming note. Since I got out of surgery, the show has been appearing on Mondays instead of late nights Friday, and I think I'm going to leave it there for the time being. It's a schedule that I can keep, and there's some movement around here, some construction that's going to be going on that will make recording during the weekdays kind of difficult. So I may need some weekend time when the banging of the hammers will not cause me to want to bang my head on the desk. Having said that, as members of the Facebook group know, I tend to let them know when I have uploaded the new episode and when it is going to publish. So, should they choose, and I'm flattered if they do, they can pounce on it as soon as it goes up. So, for example, I am saying these words on Sunday. This will be uploaded on Sunday evening, and if you want it a little ahead of Monday morning, there it will be. Enough said, and onward. Last week, I didn't get a chance to mention the passing of pitcher Scott Sanderson, who died of undisclosed causes on April 11th. He was just 62, which seems much too young. For those who don't remember Scott Sanderson, he had one of those solid careers that doesn't make the Hall of Fame or even most Hall of Very Good type assemblages. He was just one of many players who contributed to good teams for a while, making them better while never being thought of as a star himself. In Sanderson's case, that meant pitching in the big leagues for 19 seasons from 1978 through 1996, but making just one all-star team, that coming about 13 years in during the 1991 season. His career record, for what one-loss records are worth, was 163 and 143, and his ERA was 3.84, which is a smidge better than league average when you adjust for park and league environments. I think it says something about a pitcher, though, that he does get to play for almost 20 years, and yet never won 20 games and never got a single vote for Cy Young. People valued him anyway at the level that he did pitch. When he was young, he threw hard, but I don't think anyone will remember him as a burning fastball kind of guy. What they'll remember is that he had fantastic control, averaging for his career about 2 walks per 9 during that time, and getting better as his career went on, and his signature pitch, which was a big, slow curveball that he would use to freeze batters who were waiting for that fastball, which initially sat between 92 and 95 and then tailed off later, but the curveball still kept them honest. He was a star in college at Vanderbilt. He stood 6'5 and had that fastball. I guess scouts were lukewarm on him, though, because he wasn't picked until the third round of the 1977 draft. The Expos grabbed him, and they treated him like he had been a first overall draft pick, rushing him through the minor leagues in just 13 months and 28 games. Looking at the stats, you can't wholly see why they made that decision, but I guess it must have made sense at the time. He did pitch really well once he came up, logging a 2.51 ERA in 10 games and 61 innings. The results after that were less astounding, in part due to injury that kept him off the field for quite a bit in his late 20s, in part because that hard fastball didn't have a ton of movement and gradually, as I said, lost its zip with those injuries, and in part because he struggled for years to find a third pitch. If you look at what was written about him in the early part of his career, he was the kind of pitcher who would earn comments like, man, he's really good, but he should be better. His stuff is so great. I wonder why he doesn't win more games. I don't know if we hear that as much now. We seem to just accept that players are who they are. I wonder if that's because back then minor league coverage was much less extensive than it is now, and also much less scouting-oriented. So you got told about a player's bottom-line results, but not necessarily how he achieved them. Today, if a pitcher had a terrific ERA or a high strikeout in the minor leagues, the first thing we might ask is, what's his velocity? What's his age relative to the leagues he was in? How did he come by that low ERA? And sometimes you do hear, hey, don't get excited. He's just doing it on his changeup. Guys at the higher level are going to learn to lay off of that. He's a number four starter at best. Sanderson was better than that. He pitched with four postseason teams, the 1981 Expos, the 1984 and 1989 Cubs, and the 1990 A's. He was never the ace of any of those teams. The only team he was ever on that might have thought of him as their number one starter was the 1991 Yankees, and that's because that was a miserably bad team. He was very good for them, though, going 16-10 with a solid 3.81 ERA, walking just 29 in 208 innings. I believe he led the major leagues in strikeout walk ratio. Mostly, though, he was a third starter, or an overqualified four. But that's no insult. A team needs that kind of depth if it's going to win 90 or more games. When I heard that Sanderson had passed on, I thought of all the things I just told you, and I remembered he was thought of as a good guy, a spiritual guy, and he was strong for the union. I also remembered, though, this, and I quote from the New York Times, "Yank Sanderson sidesteps women in locker room." This is by Michael Martinez, April 2nd, 1991. A woman in the Yankee clubhouse? If there is one and she wants an interview with Scott Sanderson, it won't be conducted within view of his teammates. The Yankee right-hander today repeated his policy of refusing to speak with members of the news media if women are present. No exceptions. Sanderson said it was a matter of moral principle, nothing else. It's not a constitutional issue, it's a moral issue, he said. I don't believe women belong where men are dressing, and I don't believe men belong where women are dressing. The Yankees general manager at the time, Stick Michael, did meet with Scott Sanderson, apparently could not persuade him to change his mind. Michael said, everybody has their rights. He has a right to think the way he wants. What goes unsaid there is that you do have the right to think whatever the hell you want. You do not have the right to act in a way that affects other people, whatever way that you want. And Michael ducked that issue in making that statement. This is not an anti-media stance, Sanderson said. I'm trying to figure out a way not to compromise my values and not compromise your jobs. So far, no one has come up with a more equitable way to do it. Well, does it bother female sports writers? Sanderson was asked. Initially, they're mad at me, but after they talk to me and hear my feelings, they appreciate how I'm trying to help them do their jobs. I think most reporters that I've worked with over the years will tell you that I've been very cooperative. This is self-justifying bull. Anytime you take a writer, male or female, who is working on a deadline, trying to talk to the ace pitcher of a team after a game, and you make their life harder, delay their getting the quotes that they need, you are not being cooperative. And in this case, Sanderson made it harder for female reporters specifically to do their job, placed them at a disadvantage compared to their male counterparts, made them feel singled out and other. And look, this doesn't make Sanderson an evil man, merely a misguided one, but that stance diminished him then, and it diminishes his memory now. How do you want to be remembered after you're gone? After you've done all of the thousands of things you're supposed to do before you die, up to and not necessarily including the 1,000 Phillies things you're supposed to do before you die, which I'm sure put many of the other 1,000 things you're supposed to do before you die to shame, because although I have not read Bill's book, I am fairly certain that the 1,001 Phillies things that you're supposed to do before you die includes eating a whole bunch of cheesesteaks. I'm hoping that numbers 733 through 829 are in fact cheesesteak eating. And to continue what is likely to be a theme from now on, and in fact for the rest of my days, if you do find yourself in Philadelphia, please have a cheesesteak for me. To paraphrase a Paul McCartney song, eat for me, you know I can't eat anymore. And you know, I haven't had meat since 1991, so it's not even cheesesteaks I'm missing, it's chicken steaks, which is not remotely the same. I digress. I was asking how you want to be remembered, and the question is, do you want to be remembered as the person that I initially introduced Scott Sanderson to you as someone who was a solid contributor for 19 years, or maybe more than that? Maybe you've accomplished greater things than just winning an average of 13 games a year over nearly 20 years. I don't know. Or do you want to be remembered as someone who chose to take a whole class of people on the basis of their gender and make their lives more difficult to make a point of signifying to all the other male animals in your vicinity that they were lesser than just because you couldn't conceive that they were there to do a job that the last thing anyone in the clubhouse wants, male or female, is to glance at your little pink sword? And I'm not clear what happens if they do. Sanderson said it was a moral issue. I defy you to define that issue in moral terms. There's no morality to it whatsoever. It's just a fact of the human body. Yes, we all have an expectation of privacy, but if you're a Major League Baseball player, this game is supported by media coverage, and you give up the expectation of a certain amount of privacy in order that the game gets the coverage that it needs to thrive and survive. Simultaneously, the real moral issue of our time, of all times, is the pursuit of greater freedom and equality, and that means that men and women are treated equally. If you think a woman talking to you while you're wearing a towel will corrupt your morals or theirs, the problem isn't them, it's you. Or maybe, hell, we're just talking about Vice President Mike Pence. I don't really know. The one thing I do know, having been in clubhouses myself, I know that for men or women, and I do believe, although it is not done this way, that were the genders swapped, it would be the same thing, that cocktail wieners are off the menu, way off the menu. The only thing that anyone is looking for or at is a story. Sanderson was a good pitcher, though, and I did enjoy watching him pitch. Well, as usual, we will take a break for you to mull that one over. And on the other side, I will be joined by Bill Baer of Hardball Talk. I hope that you will join us as I've chilled a fine Riesling to share with you on this occasion. Well, not really share, because just like those cheesesteaks, I can't drink either. I'll see you then.
A grand old painter died last night. His paintings on the wall. Before he went, he bade us well. Said good night to us all. So drink to me, drink to my health. You know I can't drink anymore. Drink to me, drink to my health. You know I can't drink anymore. 3 o'clock in the
My next guest was the founder of the long-running Philadelphia Phillies blog Crash Burn Alley, a site which launched an uncanny number of national baseball writers and front office personnel, and then joined Craig Calcaterra's crew on NBC's Hardball Talk. He's also the author of the book 100 Things Phillies Fans Should Know and Do before they die. And personal note, he wrote for me at Baseball Prospectus, although I don't think we interacted that much since I was hands-off with the fantasy department. Consider this welcome, making up for that. He's Bill Baer. How are you, Bill?
I'm good. Thank you so much for having me on here, Stephen.
It's my pleasure. I've really enjoyed Hardball Talk over the years in that it's a really concise but snappy baseball news summary. There's still room for personality between you, Craig, and Ashley Varela. And that gives it not only color, but some depth. Even when it's very terse, the stories aren't necessarily long. They're designed to be read quickly. Every once in a while, one of you will kind of go off on a rant, but even those probably aren't so much more than 500 words. And it seems to me that even the news that you choose to cover is very carefully curated. What is the philosophy behind the site that allows you to make those selections?
I wouldn't say we have any particular philosophy. It's more like whatever we're interested in and feel compelled to talk about, we have the freedom to do that. No one has ever, you know, come down from on high and said, we need you to cover this specifically in this exact way. Maybe the playoffs is probably the most specific they've been. It's more like, make sure you're adding video and you're doing like a gamer and stuff like that. But especially during the regular season, there's so much going on and a lot of it's rote. People just generally don't really care to read about the 25th man on the bench getting injured. So if we can turn our focus to something like, hey, minor leaguers are not being compensated fairly, we can go off on a rant about that and ignore some of the day-to-day stuff.
What's really interesting to me about that is if this were your private blog or a smaller media entity than NBC, I would get that approach. I think it's a great approach. It beats being forced to write about things that neither you nor the audience care about. Some of the more major media sites, they feel obligated to do that. You got to be the first one there when, as you said, the 25th man on the Marlins, which I'm not sure, I don't know if I could even name who that is at the moment, and it's my job to do that. You guys are not under that pressure to keep the churn up. There are times, there's a long gap between stories that pop on Hardball Talk. I always wonder, and somehow I've never asked Craig about this either, how little pressure there is on you guys or how much there is to close up those gaps and get any post up there just so you keep the turnstiles going.
Yeah, I think it's a relatively unique in terms of sports blogs where you don't have like a quota that you have to meet, or you're not getting constantly pressured by people above you who might not necessarily be up on the day-to-day goings on that me and Craig have to deal with. They are kind of very hands-off. They trust us a lot. I like that personally as a writer. I like to do my own thing. I don't like someone creeping over my shoulder saying, you know, make sure you do this, make sure you do that. So for me, I couldn't have picked a better environment to continue writing.
Can I ask you something about the audience? I've noticed, I don't think this will come as a shock to you or to anyone else who has read it, that a lot of HT commentators, both on the site and on Twitter, seem to really enjoy hate reading you and Craig. You're often accused of politicizing things. Now, I'm aligned with the two of you more or less, so to me, it doesn't feel like politicization, there's a word for you, so much as just flowing out of common sense. That's where the stories go. You've never torqued anything that I can tell to fit a particular outlook or a point of view. It's just the logic of it. But in this era, of course, even facts can be disallowed by people on the basis of philosophy. But in any case, I feel like Craig enjoys the banter, the duel of wits with people who probably came unarmed to the fight. Do you find that it elevates you or that it brings you down?
I would say actually neither. I don't really write things looking for a fight or looking to engage with any particular group of people. It just sort of happens. And every now and then I, you know, may go a little too far, but that's never like a calculated thing. I know a lot of people like to throw around the word clickbait. I can't speak for Craig, but I can speak very confidently. I don't think that's a thing for either of us. I just like writing what I know and what I care about. And that's what comes out at Hardball Talk and what I had at my blog before I started doing all my writing elsewhere. So it's more what motivates me, what gets my attention, and what I feel like I can speak knowledgeably about. But there are definitely a lot of people who like to hate read me and then comment about that or or to Craig, and even to Ashley, even though she's not on the site as often as we are, so she doesn't have the volume that we do and the exposure to them that might turn their attitude sour. Because I know, at least for me, I feel like I'm a small dose guy, but where you can take me in like little quantities. But if you have to hang out with me for, you know, several hours, you might be like, I gotta go. You're not wearing a watch, but you're looking at your wrist. Like, I got somewhere to be.
I guess we'll find out by the end of this hour together, won't we?
Yeah, I feel so sorry for you.
For me as a writer, I know, like, psychologically this is wrong to do it for the praise, for the pat on the head, the gold star on the piece of paper, but I think that I do it in part out of a sense of performance, out of trying to entertain or inform people, and I do want to know that I did a good job. I made them feel good, and when I do very occasionally these days have some kind of backlash on social media, it can really ruin my day. I mean, again, that's not something that's going to surprise you. It could ruin anybody's day. But when people attack you based on a perceived favoritism, if you write something negative about a team, or because, like you said, you talk about, say, the wages in the minor leagues or something else where people can really willfully misunderstand that topic. After doing this for all these years, you've been at this a long time, does it wash off of you, or do you also have to look away for a while?
Yeah, it washes off of me very easily. I've been at it for so long. I've heard everything for a while there. I'm sure you remember I didn't even have my picture on Twitter for a while because I was insecure about people saying something mean about the way I looked. And then I just got to a point where, you know, I've already had death threats. I've already had people, you know, stalk my mom on Facebook and pull photos from her private account and post them publicly to make fun of me. So once you go through all that, you're just like, nothing can really ruin my day anymore. So after I've been at it 11 years, I started Crash Burnally in 2007. So pretty much everything is water off a duck's back at this point. There's not really that much people can say that will ruin my day.
So what motivates a person who, I apologize if I'm mischaracterizing you, but sounds very shy and reserved? What makes a person like that go out on the internet and start writing for the public?
Yeah, that's actually a really interesting question. I've never been asked that before, and you're very perceptive because you've never met me in person. But to say I'm shy and reserved would be very accurate. Craig Calcaterra met me for the first time last month because we had an NBC powwow in Connecticut. And I'm sure I can write confidently, I would say. I can be kind of abrasive. You might think that I would be that way in person, but I am definitely more shy and reserved in person. I'm not one to generate conflict. So to answer your question, what makes a person with that personality want to put himself out there on the internet? I think it's more that I felt like I had a viewpoint that wasn't represented, but I thought should be. That's why I started the blog in the first place, because I was at that point very into sabermetrics, and it was a niche interest and it wasn't as mainstream as it is now. So I felt like, oh, there's a opening for a sabermetrics oriented blog out there. And of course, I'm from the Philly area, follow the Phillies as fanatically as anyone else. So those were the two motivating factors for me to start putting myself out there.
And how long did it take you to get past that nervousness, that sense that you were going to be ridiculed by people? Because we all have that. We all at first feel like it's not even imposter syndrome. It's just going out on stage and kind of saying ta-da and then hoping nobody throws anything. You don't know until you do it whether the audience will accept you or not.
It is interesting to think about, because that's definitely a fear that I've had, and I'm sure that basically any public personality has had. Comedians, actors, writers, etc., that I'm sure they all have it to some degree or another. But I guess what got me past that was just you do it enough times and you've experienced the negative things enough times that you're kind of inoculated to it. You're just like, oh, that's my 500th article that this group of people vehemently disagreed with. You know, not much I can do about that, you know? And there's also a bit of a maturing process, because I started writing on the internet when I was 19, and I'd basically grown up publicly. It's kind of interesting to think about that way. People who have been reading me since 2007 have seen me change as a person and mature in a lot of different ways. I'll give you a good example of that. Like, I was a huge opponent of the Ryan Howard contract extension. I'm sure you remember that, the 5-year, $125 million contract extension.
Yes.
And I was like super against that. And if you read me now, it'd be hard for you to imagine me saying what I wrote back then about that, just because my viewpoint on that and the things I value and the things I consider have evolved. So for a lot of people who are in the public spotlight, they are changing constantly in front of people. And I think that also helps you get over that hump of people are going to be judging me or viewing me harshly. It's, well, I need to take some lumps in order to grow as a person.
Well, how did you approach it then? And if the same extension, the same player, were he still around, happened today, how would you handle it differently?
Handle differently, meaning in coverage?
I'm just guessing because I don't recall that particular post. I know from my own experience that when I look back on things that I wrote, well, even a year ago, but I mean, certainly 10 years ago or 20 years ago, I can be deeply embarrassed by what I thought was good or smart or clever then. And today I value a lot of things more, including kindness. So back then, if I thought, wow, I was really funny, I really nailed that player, or that general manager. Now I can be critical, but I want to be kind and critical because I don't want to add to the hostility that we just talked about. So I wonder if that's what you were referring to, or just more sophistication in your writing, or how have you evolved such that you would handle something like a contract extension you disagreed with differently?
Yeah, I'm very much where you're at in terms of valuing kindness above, you know, getting that quick zinger in or having the really sharp analysis. My first priority now is to think about, like, how is this affecting the people that I'm writing about? Because if I were to write about the Ryan Howard extension now compared to the way I wrote about it then, I would think about, if I'm against it, I'm hurting the union's cause because I'm trashing a big player contract, and that weakens the public perception of players and lessens their, leverage in negotiations, both individually and as a unit. So I'm thinking, am I actually taking potential food out of the mouths of these athletes who are in the top 0.0001% of the population just because I want to be smart? I want to make the right prediction about how the contract will turn out. So it's fun to be right, but it's not number one for me anymore. It's more about being kind and thinking about how what I write affects the subjects.
That's really fascinating, Bill, because I think what you're saying is, and this is true for a lot of us, and maybe even the guys who write mainstream stuff that doesn't necessarily have the sabermetric sophistication or is just more squarely focused on the game, but there was a point in time, and this even extends into our mostly online era, where you could just write about baseball as if you were talking about a series of baseball cards that were being shuffled around and just deal with it purely on the sports merits. And you're right that on the sports merits, the Ryan Howard contract was not a very sensible one from the point of view of the Phillies. From the point of view of the player, and the point of view of, if you care about labor rights and this union, which, yes, it represents millionaires, but is still a union, and that's an important value that we're in danger of losing in this country, then there's like an added dimension that has to inform your writing, or you're not giving the reader and yourself a full picture of all the implications of the story, which transcends sports.
Absolutely. And a lot of people think that you can divorce sports from the larger picture. They say, stick to sports, keep politics out of it. And that's just impossible. Basically, what people mean when they say that is, I have a lot of privilege and I've been able to enjoy sports without considering these things. And it's largely said by white men. So if you're a woman, you've always had to consider your gender as part of being a sports fan. Or if you're a writer, you have to consider that as part of your profession. Even if you go to the ballpark, you consider even the most innocuous seeming things, like the kiss cam stuff up there. They're showing mostly like hetero couples. They're not showing gay couples or bisexual people, stuff like that. So for people who have been raised in this cloud of privilege, they've never had to consider that. I think part of why Craig and I get a lot of hate in particular, and this, by the way, when I say a lot of hate, it's very minimal. If we were not white men, we would get so much more hate.
Yes.
So there's even privilege in me saying that. But people have been sports fans experiencing the sport, whatever sport of their choice, through that cloud of privilege, and they've never had to consider that. So when people like Craig or myself or other people point out certain things, that's kind of like a wake-up call to them, and they feel threatened. They feel like they can't enjoy the sport the way they always have, and it makes them uncomfortable. And for some people, they just reject that outright. Some people are slow to cotton on to the idea. And then there's, you know, a few people who do read it and they're like, that made me see things in a new perspective. I'm going to add that to my outlook. And they change their behavior and their perspective as a result. And as a writer, that's the greatest thing. When you hear from a reader, like, you made me think about something in a new way, that means more to me, and I'm sure you would probably agree about that, than saying, hey, that was written well.
Yeah, it absolutely does. It's a huge thing to me. And what I'm fascinated by is, again, not to repeat things, but you work for this huge monolithic company. I have always tried to write the way that you're talking about. And one of the reasons that I do this podcast is because I'm in charge of me and I can go to all those different places and not have to answer to anybody. I remember being yelled at by one of the owners of Baseball Prospectus in my early days, saying that I couldn't write that way because I would alienate half the audience no matter what I did. When I was made co-editor of the BP books, I was told no politics, as if I was just going to make every player comment Derek Jeter down with George W. Bush or whatever. It was a temptation. The point being that you don't seem to have any pressure on you. And again, to be clear, you're not doing that. You're not electioneering or anything. You're just following the stories where they go. But no one has said, hey, stick to the balls and strikes.
Yeah, we have a fairly large swath of freedom at NBC, which I'm very thankful for, because there's a lot of places where I could write what I write and get me an earful or an emailful, or it would just straight up get me fired, or they wouldn't even consider hiring me in the first place. I would say I'm a very polarizing kind of person. So for NBC to stick with me as long as I have, it kind of speaks to the atmosphere that they cultivate with their employees. And I'm not just saying that because, you know, I work for them and I'm going to blow smoke up their ass and stuff like that. I would say the same thing if they had just fired me. They treat me very well. They trust Craig and I and Ashley, and they give us a lot of freedom to do what we do. So I think there's a lot of value in that. And I wish more publications did that, especially the bigger ones. Like, I'd love to see Jeff Passan at ESPN have the full freedom to, he did a very nice report on the labor issues with the contract extensions. There was a recent spate of them. He did some outstanding reporting on that, but I would love to see him go full leftist kind of labor reporting on that. But ESPN is one of those companies where they want to dance through the middle. They don't want to lean to one side or the another, which is kind of funny, because everybody who's on the right side of the spectrum would, if you were to poll them, would say ESPN is so far left. Yeah, I would like to see more publications give their writers, and, well, not even just their writers, anybody who does media for them, because a lot of places do video as well, or podcasts, just give them the freedom to go where they want and see where that ends up, because I think the fear is more irrational than anything. I think the reality is they would alienate some people, but it wouldn't be as many as they think, and they would also bring other people in to account for any of the people who end up walking away.
Maybe this is cynical, but I wonder if part of that freedom derives from the fact that whereas ESPN is a rights holder and has to kiss up to baseball at least a little bit just to keep the relationship on solid ground, NBC, unless I miss my guess, is not a rights holder right now.
Right. Yeah, I don't believe, and I'm not involved in any of the business side of things. I just write for them. So if I'm wrong about this, I apologize in advance. But as far as I'm aware, they're not rights holders for anything involved in baseball. And that is nice. I think that does add some freedom to what you can cover. You can be a little bit more critical of them. And I've been thinking about this for a while. There's always a little bit of a, and not just a little, sometimes a lot, a conflict of interest with media and that which it covers. For example, I've been thinking a lot recently about MLB.com and the writers they have, because as we've seen recently, the free agent market has dried up. It's really hard for some free agents to find jobs. As we speak, Craig Kimbrel and Dallas Keuchel are unsigned, and they've had articles up on the site every so often, like Craig Kimbrel lowered his asking price, Dallas Keuchel doesn't want 3 years or 4 years or whatever it was anymore. And I feel like for an organization that has a vested interest in the outcomes of what happens vis-a-vis labor, there's a bit of a conflict of interest there. I don't feel like they can cover that impartially. And there's no disclaimer or anything. And I don't really know how to navigate through all of that. Like I said, I've really started thinking about it a lot recently, so I haven't gone through everything. But those are my current thoughts on the matter and my worries.
Oh, give me land, lots of land, under starry skies above. Don't fence me in. Let me ride through the wide open country that I love. Don't fence me in. Let me be by myself in the evening breeze and listen to the murmur of the cottonwood trees. Send me off forever, but I ask you please, don't fence me in.
You're listening to a real outlier of a Cole Porter song, Don't Fence Me In, which hit number one for Bing Crosby and the Andrews Sisters for about 8 weeks, straddling the end of 1944 and the first month and a half of 1945. The song actually dates from late 1934, when Porter was commissioned to write it for a Fox film, not an X-Men sequel. It was called Adios Argentina, and it had a Baroque plot about an orphaned cattle heiress who turned her ranch hands into a winning polo team. Fortunately, the film was never made, and 10 years later, Warner Brothers plucked the song off the shelf for the all-star service comedy Hollywood Canteen, which is kind of enjoyable for what it is, a variety show, where it was broken in by Mr. Double R Burger himself, Roy Rogers. This is one of the few songs on which Porter collaborated. The producer of the film asked him to adapt a poem by one Bob Fletcher of Montana. He changed it a lot for the better. I'm out of the burger-eating business for good, but if there's still a Roy Rogers in your neck of the woods, and they still sell that, I don't know if they do, but if they do, head over there, have one for me. There are a lot fewer Roy Rogers franchises than there used to be, so it might take you a while. And so, in fairness, we'll take a break while you look. I'll be back when you get back, and so will Bill Bear. See you then.
Don't fence me in. Just turn me loose. Let me straddle my...
Was one of the reasons that you saw room for a Phillies blog back when you started Crashburn Alley, or I should say a Phillies blog that had a sabermetric point of view, that the Phillies were notoriously one of the slowest teams to react to the Moneyball and post-Moneyball era? It feels like they got analytical just yesterday, basically, and we're seeing that to some extent last year, certainly at the start of this year, paying dividends for them. But was it their own slowness to modernize that spurred you on?
It was. It really was. And I guess I can thank them for that, because without them being as slow as they were, there wouldn't have been that opening for people like me or a lot of the writers who wrote for and continue to write for The Good Fight, the SB Nation blog, and other blogs out there. Yeah, they were one of the slowest teams to adopt sabermetrics or just analytics as a more broad term. I don't know the chronology of all of it, but I believe they were either number 29 or 30 to install an analytics department. I'm not sure, but maybe the Twins are the slowest, but I could be wrong about that. It was only until a few years ago. It was right around the time they got rid of Ruben Amaro Jr. and started the Matt Klentak era that they fully adopted analytics and put some serious money into that.
how did the market react to that? The reason I ask this, this is another thing that I missed, and I'm kind of sorry I missed it, but I found a reference to you in a Rob Nyer column from 2011 that wasn't about you, actually. It was about the disgraced Hall of Fame baseball writer Bill Conlon, and Rob mentioned that Conlon engaged in a long-running and vituperative email exchange with Phillies blogger Bill Baer, and Conlon didn't come out looking better for the exchange. That had to be about 2 seconds after you started the blog, if that happened in 2007. What went on there?
It was kind of funny. That might have been like what caused me to explode, as they say. It went viral. I was just, you know, 19 at the time and kind of cantankerous. So I started my blog. I don't remember exactly the way everything happened, but I don't know if I emailed Bill Conlon or if Bill Conlon emailed me. I would imagine if I had to put money on it, I would say I probably emailed him, but who knows? But it was about sabermetrics and blogging and all that. And he was just very angry and one of those cliche, closed-minded sports writers who's just the time has passed him by and he hasn't adapted to a changing world. So he expressed to me that if Hitler were alive today, he would have killed all bloggers, which is, you know, kind of a messed up thing to say, especially to a kid who's a blogger. And you may not be a blogger, but you're a writer, and writing is a sacred profession. It's the foundation of democracy. Without writers, we can't hold powerful people accountable. So to say that Hitler would have killed all bloggers is kind of to disgrace your own profession.
It's tasteless regardless.
Right, right. Absolutely. But even coming from a writer made it all the more jarring. But yeah, that's the post that went viral, and I would say that was my claim to fame at the time. I publicized it on my blog, and it started a whole debate of, like, do you publicize emails if there isn't, like, a clear indication of this is on the record or this is off the record? And my thought at the time was, I'm just a blogger. I'm not a journalist. Like, I'm not doing this for a living. I can do what I want. If he emailed me as Bill Baer, NBC sports writer, I probably wouldn't have published him just because I didn't get affirmative consent about everything that he was saying to me through email. So there was a whole secondary debate beyond what he said about the ethics of journalism and stuff like that. So it was a whole thing.
It is bizarre. I mean, I keep trying to parse that as you're talking. What would lead somebody to make that kind of analogy?
Right.
Hitler killed everybody who advocated for a free press. He murdered Sophie Scholl for distributing literature that was critical of the regime. It's just a nasty thing to say.
And I'm not sure what it added to the conversation either. It was just kind of like his dismissive way of saying, oh, you're a lowly blogger. You are beneath me.
You know what's really funny about that? And just coincidentally, I'm going to mention Rob Nyer here because this relates to a discussion that he and I had years ago. It was actually similar to where we started in this conversation today in terms of why do we get such hostility? Why do we sometimes get the assumption of bias? Rob said they think that we have a lot more power than we do. They think that we're writing from a place of access and privilege. And the funny thing is that certainly Rob wasn't in the early days. I wasn't in the early days. I'm just like anybody else. It's just that I can put a couple of words together. It seems like the old school journalists like this fellow who had some bad things going on apparently besides the hostility towards bloggers. Murray Chass is another one. They were trying to protect that thing that, ironically, the audience sometimes imagined that we had.
Right. I think there was kind of a generation gap. So you had like the print journalists, and then you had the media, or not the media, the digital journalists, like people who went on TV and did radio. And I'm sure I wasn't, you know, alive back then, or I was too young to notice any bitterness between the two sides there, but I'm sure there was animosity with that. It's just like whenever you get to a certain point, there's a dividing factor where people either adapt or they don't, and they get really crotchety and get left behind. And that, I think that's what happened to Bill Conlon. He didn't really write anything of relevance in this millennium. And I don't say that to be like pithy. It's just, I think a fact. There was nothing he wrote that had like an impact that changed the way people thought about something. To be honest, that's one of my biggest worries as a writer and as a person. Like, what happens when I get to that point? If I get to that point, like, I want to do whatever I can to not get to that point where I just, you know, I've learned all I can. I'm right about everything and that's it. Anybody who doesn't think the way I do is, you know, they're beneath me. They're a disgrace. I don't want to ever get to that point. And that's what I saw with Bill Conlon. He got to that point where his mind just like shut off and he was mailing it in.
Well, I began by asking you when you overcame self-doubt, but there are certain kinds of self-doubt that are very valuable to cultivate and to always maintain a beginner's mind, the feeling not of inauthenticity, but a feeling of, I always have so much more to learn. There are always ways that I can improve. I feel like you do. I don't ever want to be that guy. I want to be curious right until the end, always feeling like somebody can teach me. When I did chats at Baseball Prospectus, one of the things that I almost always ended the chats with was thanking the readers for the privilege of letting me learn from them. Because whereas we do get to write from a place of authority, especially if we're good writers, we're going to construct our arguments in such a way that they can't be picked apart. You do need to, when you're not doing that, be open to being corrected or learning something that you didn't know before. Otherwise, you're right. You do stagnate.
Yeah. And I see that a lot with writers, unfortunately, even some of my heroes or past heroes. And I'm not going to name names because that's not, you know, what this is about, but it's unfortunate to see that people get to a place of where they have the power to influence people and they have access to so many different perspectives. And this isn't like one of those centrist sentiments. Like, you have to consider everybody's opinion. You know, they're all equally valid. Not all opinions are worth considering, but
right. When
you are, you know, held to task, if you write something that sucks, that you didn't research carefully enough, that you didn't consider a certain angle, it's important to be able to listen to that person and not take it as a personal attack and be like, how could my writing improve from this? Or how could my perspective, how could my approach to writing about it be better or different? A lot of people that I read, you know, in the early 2000s, at the start of this decade, like some people just haven't really adapted, and I just don't read them anymore because they're not giving me anything new. I think the writers have to change along with their audiences as well. Otherwise, you get to a certain point where someone has heard all they need to hear from you because you're not. How many times can you say, I'll use myself as an example, that I wrote about the Ryan Howard contract being bad. How many times can I write about a contract being bad? You know, people get bored about that. So you need to constantly shift your focus to something that's different, more important. Your values need to evolve. Otherwise, people are just going to get bored reading what you have to say.
In our field, that's a real challenge, too, because, I mean, I started doing this. I turned pro, for want of a better term, in the 1990s. This is before Moneyball came out. It was after Bill James, but Bill James hadn't gone mainstream in the way that his thoughts would later adapted by everybody else. There was still room to tell people, hey, the batting average, home runs, and RBIs that are the only stats published in most papers, it's not enough. You need to learn some other things. But very rapidly, what was kind of the bleeding left edge of baseball commentary became common knowledge for everyone and moved to the center. And so you did have to reinvent yourself and find new things to say because people, I think now, I don't know if you find this also, come with almost an a priori knowledge of those things such that it's not about education and saying how, again, as I said earlier, how dumb X team is being because they signed this guy who only takes 15 walks a year. None of them are going to sign a guy who takes only 15 walks a year.
Right. And I think you know this as well as anyone. Like, we used to have to explain wins above replacement or Baseball Prospectus's WARP to people pretty much any time that we cited the stat. But now people just know that stuff after having been exposed to it so much. If you say Baseball Reference wins above replacement, they know what you're talking about. Or Fangraphs win above replacement, they know that. they know the differences. You don't have to parse it out every single time. So I would definitely agree with you that people have that a priori knowledge of sabermetrics, where it's not a, it shouldn't be the focal point of your writing anymore. You're no longer educating because it's part of the culture now. People come pre-equipped with that knowledge. So what are you going to do with that? What are you using all those stats to say, or how are you using that to affect the way people think about the game? I think one of the big things now, especially with the way people have abused, it's commonly written out as $/WAR.
Yeah.
It's basically how much money a player is worth based on how much wins above replacement he produced. It's kind of a quick shorthand, but people abuse that and they say, well, he's getting paid $25 million this year, but he only produced $10 million worth of value. He's a bad player. The contract is a sham, stuff like that. So if you're not pushing back on the way people abuse the stats that you popularize, there's also kind of you're failing in that regard as well, beyond not just pushing new ideas.
There was one particular writer who I'm not going to name who popularized that kind of thinking. I never got it. I didn't understand why it caught on, because the value of a contract is not just about dollars per war. It's also contextual. And if overpaying for somebody's services gets you from the 89 to the, I don't know, 93 win mark, that's a lot more valuable to, I don't know, the Red Sox than it is to the Marlins. So yeah, for the Marlins, it's an overpay. And for the Red Sox, it's going to put them in the World Series. So this is a way too simplistic, two-dimensional or one-dimensional analysis. And I'm glad that people like you are pushing back on that.
Yeah, and there's a great example just this past offseason with Bryce Harper and the Phillies, right? $330 million for 13 years. You know, that's about one-third of $1 billion. Who could possibly be worth that much money, you know? But you saw it right away. Right as spring training began, Bryce Harper, Phillies jerseys were selling like gangbusters. They were selling out tickets, season tickets, and just single game tickets. And if you look at attendance figures now, their attendance has skyrocketed. It's paid off immediately, and it will likely continue to pay off, although there will be, you know, a drop off. The fervor is going to die down. The honeymoon period will end, but that's better than having a, you know, a 75 win team, adding a Bryce Harper to your team. Whether they're, you know, on the precipice of the playoffs or they're just about done the rebuilding process as the Phillies were, that has a very legitimate impact. And that's not encapsulated by single stats, even the sabermetrics one, as well detailed as they may be. They don't consider things like marketing or the marginal value of a win. Like you said, there's a lot of context to these stats that often goes unaddressed.
I'm fascinated by the attendance boom and the merchandising boom and so on that the Phillies have experienced. It's such a wonderful thing because it points out something so elemental, which is that spectacle, names, celebrity, achievement too, but all of those things, that's what sells tickets. And on this program last week, Jesse Spector said, not joking, that actually trying is the new market inefficiency. It's so obvious, and yet it seems like it's been forgotten by 29 of the 30 baseball teams.
Right. And if you look at the stats, sure, a top 10 draft pick, you're more likely to hit on than having a lower draft pick. But it's not so much more where it justifies self-imposed austerity measures where you're cutting your payroll from, you know, $125 million to $75 million just because you want to really tank in the standings for a year or two and stockpile a few high draft picks. It really is. Trying is the new market inefficiency. And you're seeing teams like the Phillies and the Padres exploit that, because the Padres were surprising, not just because they signed Manny Machado to a $300 million contract over 10 years, but they also didn't play the service time manipulation game with Fernando Tatis Jr., which a lot of teams do. They're like, I'll get myself that extra year of contractual control. I won't call him up until mid-April once it's secured that he won't get that full year of service time. And then we're all good to go. The Padres had him start the season with the major league team on day one. They get off to a really good start. And who knows where they go from here. But if you think about it, I don't have the standings right in front of me, but so many games above 500. And what does the average playoff team, how many games above 500 are they? There are some playoff teams that are, you know, 88 wins. So the Padres have to be barely better than 500 the rest of the way in order to make the playoffs. And that's because they had Fernando Tatis Jr. start the season on the major league team. And they got Manny Machado, but
right. You can look at the season that way in kind of discrete chunks and just say, hey, they just have to win this much to go the rest of the way. And it's funny because when I was a kid, I find an excuse to bring this up. I feel like every episode, but the 1984 Tigers began the season 35-5 and the pennant race was over in May. And for it, what felt like 15 years after, the emphasis for every team was getting out of the gate fast because they had been so awed and traumatized by that start. And then the arbitration stuff took over and they said, yeah, no, we can do without Chris Bryant for 2-3 weeks.
And that was it's been a plague on baseball, the service time manipulation thing, because the fans lose out and the fans have always sided with ownership on labor issues. And it's always been surprising to me. I guess it shouldn't have been surprising to me because people often vote against their own economic interests. But if you think about it, what do the fans get from Fernando Tatis Jr. starting the year at AAA instead of the major leagues? So by the Padres doing that, they get that extra year of contractual control down the line. That's a factor in 7 years. For the fan right now, they're just not seeing the best roster the Padres could possibly put together. So they're seeing whoever, some fill-in. I know that's not the case specifically for the Padres because they have Julio Urias, and I can't roll my R, so I apologize for pronouncing that incorrectly, but I would do greater disservice with an attempt there. But yeah, the Padres happen to have a decent stand-in, and the fact that they still chose to have Fernando Tatis Jr. start the season on the major league speaks volumes. And I wish more teams follow in their footsteps because they're doing right by their fans. And that's really the most important thing. And it's something that's been forgotten, especially as teams have diversified their revenue streams. The Braves are a really good example with this. Their owner, Liberty Media, they have so many business ventures outside the Braves where they're kind of like a tertiary interest.
Right.
They're focus isn't so much putting the best Braves roster on the team, but doing so in a financially prudent way. And that means that the Braves didn't go out and get Manny Machado. They didn't get Craig Kimbrell. They didn't get Dallas Keuchel. Really, the only guy they got was Josh Donaldson, and he was just a rental. He signed a 1-year deal. Braves fans don't necessarily get to see him next year, no matter how good he is. If he has a good year, he probably looks for a 3-year deal in the offseason because he was coming off an injury, so he took a 1-year deal to rebuild his value.
Right.
And it's unfortunate for Braves fans because this team just won the NL East. They have a really good core of players. And if you build around that, even with the Phillies adding Bryce Harper, if the Braves added, let's say, Keuchel and Kimbrell, and they still can, by the way, I think they're pretty clear favorites in the NL East, and that's worth something to fans. It's not necessarily worth something to ownership. If they can squeak by and win the division, that means a lot more to them. And the Indians are the AL example. Going into the season, their outfield was a huge issue. They could have upgraded that any number of ways. They could have added a couple of relievers, bolstered the bench in case of an injury, which we've seen to Lindor and Kipnis. And they just didn't add any of those safeguards. And they opened up the season with a dreadful offense and they're slow to start. And they were the preseason favorite to win the AL Central. And I'm not sure that they are anymore.
What you said a few minutes ago about Tatis being a problem potentially for the Padres and fans to deal with in 7 years reminded me of something that John Maynard Keynes, the British economist, was supposed to have said. He was a big fan of spending money. Fan is the wrong word. He invented the philosophy of spending money now. If the economy was dragging, you went into debt as a government to spend money. And someone responding to that said, but in the long run, and he replied, in the long run, we're all dead.
Right.
And I mean, it seems like it applies exactly the same way. I don't know where I'm going to be in 2031 or for that matter, tomorrow. So I'd like to see some winning baseball now, please.
Hearts that are broken and love that's untrue, these go with learning the game. feeling so sad and you're all alone and blue, that's when you're learning the game.
It seems appropriate to lead off here by mentioning that this is one of the many songs that Buddy Holly did not live to record in an official way. It was found in his apartment after his premature death, having gotten on the wrong plane at the wrong time with the wrong pilot at age 22. What you're hearing is his demo, overdubbed by studio musicians and released. It's a fantastic song with a maturity way beyond his years, and it applies on at least two levels to what Bill and I were just discussing. Speaking of Bill, he and I will be back to wrap our conversation after this brief intermission and to invoke the title of another song I might have used in this spot. Enjoy yourselves. It's later than you think.
Feeling so sad and you're all alone and blue, that's when you're learning the game.
Speaking of winning baseball, let me ask you something about this year's Phillies. They're currently, as we speak, 9-6, but they were 9-6 at this time last year as well, and that team finished 80-82 after a nosedive, a spiraling crash out of the postseason, or out of the race for the postseason, I should say. Does this look like a real, honest-to-goodness 95-win team to you now?
I don't know if I'd say 95. I think definitely in the 90s, just because adding Bryce Harper to a team that won 80 games last year. I'm not saying he's going to add 10 wins on his own, but a pretty significant boost. And then his addition plus Andrew McCutchen allowed them to move Rhys Hoskins back to first base. So the defense improves just on that alone. I would say that might even be, to use a sabermetric win valuation, a win on its own, because he was so bad in left field last year. And there's also some guys that are underperforming that I don't think will continue to underperform, like through the long haul of the season, Nick Pivetta, and then Aaron Nola, who's also struggled. He has allowed 5 runs or more in 2 of his 4 starts this year, which he didn't do in any of his 33 starts last year. And I don't think that's a trend that's going to continue. I have a lot of confidence whole. Turn things around and be the ace that he showed he was last year. There's some other guys like Odubel Herrera hasn't really hit his stride yet. JT Realmuto hasn't done a whole lot. And I think once those guys get cooking, Bryce Harper will cool off and those guys starting to produce will more than make up for Bryce Harper cooling off from his hot start. And I do see this team at least sneaking into the 90s in wins. And if things go their way, they can definitely be a 95-win team. But that's more of, as they say, like a 85th percentile projection.
You know what makes me a bit twitchy is, as you said, last year the defense was super bad, the worst in baseball, arguably. And just on a balls-in-play basis this year, and it's very early, we can't really read anything into anything at 15 games. Everything could be a fluke. It won't stabilize for quite a while. But what seems consistent is, as great as it was to get Hoskins out of left field and over to first base, you still have Herrera in center. He's not the world's greatest instinctive center fielder. He's the kind of guy who might play up and left, I imagine. And Michael Franco is still kind of scary at third base. So statistically, it's still not looking great. And I wonder if this is going to be a drag on them once again.
Right. And Bryce Harper didn't grade out well defensively last year either, although moving back to a corner as opposed to playing a decent amount of center field as he had been doing in Washington helps. And Andrew McCutchen, he doesn't really have the wheels he once did. So their defense is still subpar. And I would imagine, like you said, the stats won't stabilize for a while. In fact, defensive stats, I generally don't consider in single season samples unless to say what happened. I would say on paper, this is still a significantly below average defensive team. The difference is the offense this year is worlds better. They were losing a lot of, they were scoring 1 and 2 runs and a lot of losses last year in games they would have otherwise won if they had Bryce Harper. So I think the offense is the difference maker this year, as opposed to expecting a full turnaround from the defense. Although I will give credit to the Phillies. They went a little too gung-ho analytically last year. They shifted so much and they did it so poorly. That was one of the big criticisms of Gabe Kapler, was the shifting. And they haven't done that as much this year. They've also kind of just let people fill in their roles as they feel comfortable. They're starting Scott Kingery at third base tonight more out of necessity than, hey, let's do an experiment. They were doing a lot of experimenting last year. They had people very much out of their element. And I think that contributed a bit to the historically terrible defensive numbers they had. So along with the offense, I think some other smaller things will also help on the defensive end.
This might put you on the spot because I don't expect you'll have the roster in front of you, but this is just something I was kind of wool gathering about earlier. You're right that the lineup is so much improved. I was thinking as I was considering that fact that the 1980 team, which went 91-71, which isn't great, but made their way through the playoffs and won the first championship in the franchise's history, had an inferior lineup to this year's team, which sounds weird to say when you're talking about a world championship team. But even though that club had some players who were very good offensive performers or even great offensive performers in their prime, like Pete Rose and Greg Luzinski, they had off years that year. And the only player who had a really historically great offensive season was the MVP of the National League, Mike Schmidt, who hit 48 home runs and slugged something like .624 that year. I think this is a better offensive team. I don't know if it's a better defense. I don't think so. And I don't think it's a better pitching staff. For one thing, that team had a closer, and I'm not sure this one does.
In this era, I would say that the need for a closer isn't as great as it used to be, especially back then, you know, having a Tug McGraw was vitally important, but didn't really have a guy like that this year. But they roll switch so much in the bullpen. It might be Sir Anthony Dominguez one night closing out the game. It might be, honestly, I would be surprised to see Adam Morgan closing out a game at some point. You have David Robertson, who's currently injured. Victor Urbano, who had a stellar outing recently where he struck out 6 batters in 2 innings. That's pretty much the best you can do, unless your catcher drops a third strike. They may not have the Craig Kimbrel, and I have advocated they should on Twitter frequently. They should go out and get a Craig Kimbrel. They're fine without him as well. It's not as optimal, but they can persist on the strength of their offense. I think that offense will carry them through a lot of trials. Defensively, like we're seeing with the starting pitching right now, not being so great. And then when the bullpen inevitably falters, and it will, that's just part of baseball. There will be a stretch in June or July where the bullpen blows, you know, 4 straight games, and it's frustrating as hell to watch as a fan. You just, sometimes the offense is going to lift you out. And that's the difference, I think.
You know what really fascinates me about this idea of not having the Craig Kimbrel, and I don't mean that he's not worth signing should they be the team that chooses to do so, but just the idea that you can go with a bullpen by committee if you have effective relievers who you can deploy to the right spots. It puts more pressure on the manager, obviously, than just having this rote, like, this guy's the 7th inning guy, that guy's the 8th inning guy, and then, you know, your Aroldis Chapman or Craig Kimbrel equivalent is your 9th inning guy. It used to be that if you asked a manager about that, they would say, oh no, they have to know their roles. They get too weird or freaked out, or they're superstitious about it. You can't use the 6th inning guy in the 9th inning and the 9th inning guy in the 6th inning. Well, for me, I grew up watching that. I used to see Goose Gossage coming in the 2nd sometimes. I'm not advocating that necessarily, but it's amazing that at least some teams are past that thinking.
Yeah, and you're certainly right that what we're seeing with bullpen usage isn't exactly new. Like, even the opener idea, it didn't just come to us in this decade. Some teams had experimented with that in the past. I can't rattle them off the top of my head, but certainly there's been reporting on that in the past. It just didn't stick.
Well, there's the famous Curly Ogden World Series game, but that was more of a one-off.
Right, and it wasn't like a thing that caught on just because people back then didn't have the exposure to new ideas right that we do now. So there wasn't as much pressure to, you know, change your way of thinking. But now there is, and there's a lot of pressure on people in front offices and managers to consider the newest ways to look at data to handle your personnel. We see a lot more experimentation. I think the sport's better off for it, but I do worry, and this is sort of a sidetrack, thinking about like what the Rays are doing with the opener. There's a little bit of a labor issue with that because traditional starters are not getting those starts anymore. Or relievers like Sergio Romo are not closing out games, they're actually starting some games. leagues, so they'll have fewer saves at the end of the year. And these are a lot of stats that are considered in arbitration hearings. They're not super advanced even in 2019. They still, to some degree, use wins and losses. They use games started. They use saves and ERA. They're not necessarily always looking at FIP or WOBA, the more modern stats. So just something that we need to consider, the modern way that we experiment with players.
For those who think that that's sort of not a real thing, to think of that as a labor issue, I'm always reminded of this setup man that the Mets had in the 90s. His name was Jeff Innes. He was a sidearmer. He wasn't a great pitcher by any means. He was effective, though. I'm not sure which year this was. Let's say 1991. That year, he pitched 84.2 innings out of the bullpen, had an ERA of 2.66, but it happens that he never saved a game. It was all in middle relief, and his one-loss record was 0-2. So when it was time for him to go to arbitration, the Mets, and I clearly remember this quote, said, "We don't need to give this pitcher a raise. He neither won nor saved a game for us this year. Obviously, he didn't contribute anything."
Yeah, and teams have always used that against the players. They've been pretty shameless about talking shit, as they say, about their own players to their faces in arbitration. When you think about it, it's kind of soulless to do that. Like, you have this guy wear your name across his chest for 162 games over a season, all the blood, sweat, and tears that comes with that, and then time comes, he wants a raise for his outstanding performance, and you look him right in the eye and say, "You neither won nor saved a game for us." If I were, I would have been incredibly personally insulted by that. And the fact that that's like baked into baseball's labor structure, it's baked into a lot of labor structures, but it's kind of bewildering that we allow that to happen when you think about it.
So before we wrap up here, we're in just the last couple of minutes. What else have you observed in this young season that has got you feeling good, feeling bad, just has stimulated you here as we're heading into the third week?
To be honest, it's the young players. Like I mentioned, Fernando Tatis Jr. coming up and having a really good start with the Padres, but we've seen Vladimir Guerrero Jr. He just came back. He was injured during spring training and got a late start to the season, just off to another blistering start in the minor leagues. He has nothing left to learn there, so we should be seeing him soon. There's so many young players across the league. I even consider like Aaron Nola to be a young player, Juan Soto, Victor Robles. There's so much youth and so much talent across the league to look forward to that will be here for a decade plus to come. That's what really has me excited about baseball, because it makes me feel old. Like there's a Blue Jays reliever. His name escapes me, but he was the first player to make the major leagues that was born in the 2000s. And I was like that Matt Damon gif where he ages very quickly.
My friend, I am much older than you, and you are just starting down a road that has no turning back. I'm sorry to say.
You make it sound so fun.
It's a tough thing to adjust to, let me tell you. I will say that one of the players that you mentioned that I'm most excited about is Juan Soto. I mean, he's not a new thing anymore, I guess, having been up for most of last year. But when you have a kid who comes up at 19 and shows the kind of power and plate judgment he did at that age, and you just project a little growth, not a lot even, just a little growth, you have a monstrous player.
You really do. I'm sure you saw that home run he hit against the Phillies that went above the foul pole. And they had to review it. Went something like 465 feet. So imagine how hard you have to hit a baseball to pull it 465 feet. This isn't like out the center field 465 feet. This is pulled. And that just blew my mind. And how he kept that ball fair blew my mind. But I don't think people appreciate enough what he did last year at the age of 19, the season he had. Not even Bryce Harper put up those numbers at that age. And not many players have. Like you said, if we project that out a little bit, he already has, he's pretty filled out. He's still going to get bigger, but it's not like some of these skinny guys that are coming up. You're like, he'll add, 25 pounds of muscle and then he'll have some power. It's already there for a large part for him. That's some power that you can bank on. And as a Phillies fan, I'm not going to be enjoying watching him victimize Phillies pitching over the next, decade plus.
Let's say he doesn't get better at all. As of today, he has played exactly 162 career games, one full season. He has hit .288 with a .402 on base percentage, .509 slugging, 36 doubles, 30 home runs. I mean, if he can just do that every year, we're looking at an inner circle Hall of Famer. I know that's easier said than done, but it's still going to be a lot of fun to see if he does that. The publication is the Hardball Times. The writer and my guest has been Bill Baer. Thank you so much for dropping by today, Bill.
Thank you for having me on. It was a pleasure talking with you.
Holy moly, we have reached the end of another show, and Bill was wrong. I found him pleasant company right to the very end of things. You can follow him on Twitter at Baer_Bill. Throws you a little change up there, going for the classic name reversal and underscore maneuver. And don't forget, you spell Baer, B-A-E-R. As for me, you can follow me at Go Stephen Goldman. Why Go Stephen Goldman? Because when they've hit you over the fence, it's the only thing you can do. You can also write us by, which I mean me, at infiniteinning@gmail.com. And there's a Facebook group. Go to Facebook, knock. I will let you in. No special password like Lefty sent me required. And remember, just because you join a Facebook group doesn't mean you're old. Should you be generously inclined and wish to support this podcast to make sure that it is a permanent ongoing thing, please go to patreon.com/theinfiniteinning. And on that note, I would like to welcome the latest enrollees into our Infinite Inning, Infinite Roll of Honor, Jeff Tripoldi, Lane, Eric, and Kevin Potter. Thank you, Jeff, Lane, Eric, and Kevin Potter. It means so much. Finally, should you find yourself with a spare moment, go to the podcatcher of your choice, Apple, iTunes, or what have you, and rate, review, and subscribe. It helps the show gain attention. I would appreciate it so much. Thank you. Our theme song, which you are hearing now, was a co-composition of myself and Dr. Rick Mooring, who asks, if you ever do get around to doing that voodoo that you do so well, how much pain will be incurred and will it be worth it to me? Well, if the Attorney General clears me of all accusations despite evidence to the contrary, I'll be back next week with more tales and discussion from inside the Infinite Inning.